This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk to Rashid Khalidi, who just authored the book Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. In this remarkable book, Rashid points out that the so-called independent broker always has its finger on the scales in favor of the Israelis.
We'll talk with an attorney representing peace activists in Washington state who were the victims of military spying.
For decades, activist lawyers have been trying to get the military out of the business of spying and trying to destroy peace organizations in the United States. This case may finally achieve that.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, we sorely miss our friend Lynn Stewart, who's in prison serving a really unjust 10-year sentence. And of course, as we've reminded our listeners over the last few weeks, Lynn is taken ill again, and there's a petition for her. And I know you want to talk about it and get as many people active, because we want to get Lynn out of prison on a compassionate release. So tell our listeners how they can help and what the situation is now for Lynn.
Well, we're going to link to how you can sign the petition. Lynn's got stage 4 cancer, as a lot of you know. That is her initial cancer, which was in remission when they put her in prison 3 years ago, is now in full bloom. It's spread to her bones, it's spread to her legs, spread to her lungs, it's spread to her lymph nodes, and it really is fatal. We all want to get her out and get her some better medical care than she can get. She's in a 7-person cell down in Fort Worth, Texas. Get her up to New York, better medical care, and be surrounded by her family and friends. And in order to do that, the Bureau of Prisons, the people with the key, have to make a motion to Judge Codal to ask that she be given a compassionate release. It's possible you can get that. They don't do it very often. But with all the friends and supporters that Lynn has, we're hopeful that we can accomplish that. 6,000 people have signed the petition so far. And I want to read you what Lynn said in thank you to these people. Two of them were Dick Gregory and Desmond Tutu, and I'll read you something that Tutu said also. But hear this from Lynn. I want you individually to know how grateful and happy it makes me to have your support. It's uplifting, to say the least, and after a lifetime of organizing, it proves once and again that the people can rise. The acknowledgement of the life political and solutions brought about by group unity and support is important to all of us. Equally, so is the courage to sign on to a demand for a person whom the government has branded with the T word, terrorism. Understanding that the attack on me is a subterfuge for an attack on all lawyers who advocate without fear of government displeasure, with intellectual honesty guided by their knowledge and their client's desire for his or her case, I hope our effort can be a crack in the American bastion. Thank you, Lynn. Pete Seeger wrote her back and said, Lynn Stewart should be out of jail, and he signed the postcard, Old Pete Seeger, accompanied by a drawing of a banjo. Bishop Desmond Tutu, this was his cri de coeur. He said, it is devastating, totally unbelievable. In this democracy, the only superpower, I'm sad, I will sign, praying God's blessing on your efforts, Desmond Tutu.
Let's hope Lynn gets out on compassionate release while she's still able to at least be part of her community.
And if you'll go to lawanddisorder.org, we'll put up the link where you can sign the petition. And if you'll grab a pencil, I'll give you the name and address of the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, because a well-aimed letter at him is not going to hurt. His name is Charles E. Samuels, Jr., Federal Bureau of Prisons, 320 First Street Northwest. Repeat, 320 First Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20534. 20534. Please send a letter, go to lawanddisorder.org, our website, sign the petition. We'll be updating you every week on how Lynn is doing.
Last Friday, April 5th, is an important anniversary. It's the third anniversary of the release of what has been referred to, or what is called, the collateral murder video. That's the video that WikiLeaks released that shows the killing of two Reuters journalists. It then shows the gung-ho aerial weapons team in the helicopter go after the people who are trying to come to help the Reuters journalist, and the incredible joy at the bloodlust of the people in the helicopter who continue to kill the people in Iraq on the ground. The importance of it is, of course, that it is a video that was given to WikiLeaks by Bradley Manning, the young private first class who is currently on trial at Fort Meade and facing life imprisonment for giving this video, along with other documents, to WikiLeaks. The video then was allegedly de-encrypted by WikiLeaks and put up on the web and everywhere. And it's some of the most chilling war footage you can ever see. And of course, it's an indication of what else is probably out there, hundreds of other videos like that. It's the video that really moved Bradley Manning, according to his own testimony, to start uploading and giving documents and other material to WikiLeaks. Listen now while we hear an excerpt of Bradley Manning's statement about why he gave this video to WikiLeaks.
The most alarming aspect of the video to me, however, was the seemingly delightful bloodlust the aerial weapons they appeared to have. They dehumanized the individuals they were engaging and seemed to not value human life by referring to them as, quote, dead bastards, unquote, and congratulating each other on the ability to kill in large numbers. At one point in the video, there's an individual on the ground attempting to crawl to safety. The individual is seriously wounded. Instead of calling for medical attention to the location, one of the aerial weapons team crew members verbally asked for the wounded person to pick up a weapon so that he can have a reason to engage. For me, this seems similar to a child torturing ants with magnifying glass.
That was Bradley Manning in court giving his reasons as to why he gave the video. Michael Smith, a few weeks ago, we talked about how Geo Corporation, a big private prison company, got naming rights for a stadium at Florida State University in Boca Raton, Florida. Well, we're all outraged because it's a private prison company, now they're naming stadiums. This is like an extension. A next, you know, of course, stadiums are famous as prisons and coups, apart from everything else. So is this going to next be used when there's a coup in the United States to put all of us in? But we have at least an important, I hope, a victory. I don't know what happened here. Michael, what happened?
It's a big victory. The Geo Corporation spent $6 million to get naming rights for the athletic stadium in Boca Raton for Florida State University. And it looked like the deal was going to go down. There was a huge uprising of the students and professors at Florida State. And they showed that Geo Corporation had been cited for death of prisoners and some of the prisons they run, for abuse of prisoners. And they thought the whole idea of going to an athletic stadium named after a private prison corporation was really disgusting and opposite of what values people are supposed to learn at a university. And they backed the university down. The university had to return $6 million to the Geo Corporation, and they're going to call the stadium Florida State University Stadium.
Michael, it's a real ray of bright light, because the idea that we're naming everything after these private prisons, I mean, it's like so shocking. But we actually got people in, as you said, in Boca Raton.
It's like the upper middle class resort destination. We all look at it from the Northeast that way. But, you know, it's something else. It's a militant student body that rolled back this private prison corporation. A shout out to the students and the professors at that school.
And here to give us an update on the hunger strike at Guantanamo is Omar Farah, an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Omar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Omar, we're here because we wanted you to update on the hunger strike at Guantanamo that's continuing. And first, tell our listeners who you represent at Guantanamo.
I personally represent six prisoners at Guantanamo. Fahad Ghazi is one of the men that I represent, Muhammad Al-Hamiri, and also Tariq Baouda, who is one of the long-term hunger strikers who's been on a hunger strike since February of 2007 and is force-fed daily. So as you know, there's a long history of hunger striking at Guantanamo that has been sort of expanded since this February 6th mass hunger strike and protest that's occurring at the base.
And can you tell us why there's the hunger strike? How many people are currently participating?
We've been getting consistent reports from every prisoner that's had contact with their attorneys that there is a hunger strike at Guantanamo that has near universal participation from all of the prisoners in Camp 6 and many of them in Camp 5 as well. And Camp 6 is the primary communal living facility at Guantanamo, which houses somewhere on the order of 130 prisoners. So we're looking at well over half of the entire Guantanamo prison population that is refusing food. And this was triggered by an arbitrary crackdown by the prison administration, including cell searches and a search of the prisoners' Qurans, which is viewed as outright desecration. But to be clear, it's driven by the torment of 11 years in indefinite detention without charge or trial. And that existential uncertainty is what's really pushing this hunger strike forward and what's causing the men so much physical and psychological damage.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important for people to understand. This is going on 11 years, and there's no plan to get the people out, even though a majority have been cleared for release, even though there's a waiver provision that the president can use, but he hasn't. Has this hunger strike brought a lot of attention to the situation, which seemed to have disappeared in the second term of Obama?
That's exactly right. And it's clear to us from doing this work, from meetings with the government and appearances we've had both in U.S. federal court and in front of international human rights bodies, that the government no longer has any plan to close Guantanamo, and even if it had a plan, has no political commitment to doing it. In that context, I think the best result for the government is for people to simply forget about Guantanamo altogether. The primary complaint we're getting is that it's really motivated by an attempt to get public attention back on Guantanamo. And the funny thing is, of course, that's true, and there's nothing wrong with it. You know, public scrutiny of Guantanamo brought to light some of the most shameful U.S. detention practices and torture. And so it's understandable that the prisoners now want the world to remember that they're stuck in indefinite detention without charge of trial for now more than 11 years.
As you said, without charge and trial, but a certain number have actually been cleared by both the Bush and Obama administration for release. What is that number?
It's 86 prisoners, more than half of the entire prison population, and it's a point that we just can't repeat enough. More than half of the entire prison population has been unanimously cleared for release by every prominent national security and law enforcement agency in the U.S. government. That includes Department of Defense, Homeland Security, Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This myth that the government seems to perpetuate that who remains at Guantanamo are the worst of the worst and that they pose a threat to our national security is belied by their own disposition.
You know, I think people ought to be screaming about this. And the center was right on the front lines of this, the first case ever brought regarding Guantanamo. What are people being asked to do? What's the center asking people to do? And where can people go for more information about what to do?
Well, we'd invite your listeners to come to our website and to look at not just our action requests, but also to get information about the specific prisoners who are down there. Because you know the president's Guantanamo policy now is really predicated on the same kind of secrecy that governed the Bush and Cheney administration. As much as we fight in court, this is really a political problem. The president has determined that there are other priorities other than this human rights crisis unfolding at Guantanamo that deserve his attention, and he clearly has a plan to simply abandon his promise to close Guantanamo. So we want people to call the White House and demand that he require his Secretary of Defense, Hagel, to begin certifying men for release from Guantanamo. And as much as we have fought against the NDAA, which includes onerous transfer restrictions, your listeners should be clear that the president has the legislative latitude to release prisoners if he had the political will to do so. And so this problem really begins and ends with him. And we want people to push him to act, to live up to his promise, and to recognize that if he chooses not to, that the shame of Guantanamo will be an enduring part of his legacy.
Omar Farah from the Center for Constitutional Rights, an attorney for Guantanamo detainees. I really want to thank you for your work and for that very powerful statement about where the blame for the continuation of Guantanamo lies.
Thank you so much for having me and for all your work on this issue.
Thank you, Omar.
Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi has written an important book, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. The book focuses on three periods of opportunity that the United States had to broker peace, one in the late 70s, another in the early 90s, and again in 2010. It's a critical analysis and addresses the really Orwellian language that's used to corrupt and confuse people when they try to figure out what's going on there. Rashid Khalidi is an Arab-American historian of the Middle East, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia, and the director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. He joins us today to talk about his book, Brokers of Deceit. Rashid, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've written a really smart book. I would tell people if they read one book all year about what's going on with the United States and Israel, it should be Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. And you frequently mention Orwell, which I thought was perfect. Talk to us about why. What's the deceit here? What's the use of language? Why are people in a fog about what's really been going on for the last three decades?
Well, since we have a little bit of time, let me read you what Orwell says. He says, "The slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. If thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. A bad usage can spread by tradition and imitation, even among people who should and do know better." This is something he wrote in 1946. And the argument that I'm making in this book is that much of the language that is used by pundits and policymakers, politicians, about the Middle East and the so-called peace process between the Palestinians and the Israelis is really corrupt language. There has been a process ongoing, brokered by the United States, at least since 1978, since President Carter, President Sadat, and Prime Minister Begin met at Camp David. That process has not produced peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It's produced many other things, including Egyptian-Israeli peace. But my argument in this book is that as far as the Palestinians and the Israelis are concerned, in fact, American policy has produced the opposite. It has made the situation infinitely worse. So calling it a peace process is a distortion, is a corruption of language. And that's just one example of a number of them that I bring up in the book.
When you say it's made it infinitely worse, elaborate on that.
One of the chapters in the book is devoted to the period when I was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation in negotiations from 1991 to 1993, starting in Madrid and continuing in Washington for the better part of 2 years. If you go back to Madrid in October 1991, there were under 200,000 Israeli settlers living in the occupied West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem. Today, there are nearly 600,000 of them. This is an example of what has happened during 20 years of the peace process. I could give you other examples. So the situation has gotten immeasurably worse, and my argument in the book is the United States has not just been responsible for not solving the problem, but has actually exacerbated the problem by, in effect, saying the only way to deal with this issue of occupation and settlement is through negotiations mediated by us. The United States, in the meantime, has put its big thumb on the scale in favor of the Israelis, preventing a resolution of the problem. So the United States is not just guilty of negligence. It's actually guilty of helping to foster a situation where resolving this problem is infinitely more difficult today in 2013 than it was in 1991 or 1993 when the Oslo Accords were signed.
It's a completely fascinating book, Rashid. I couldn't put it down. And you go through three instances where the U.S. has really put its thumb on the scale to make sure that there won't be peace between Israel and Palestine. Now, I'd like you to just run through those three instances. The first one took place late summer 1982,
right,
and that was the follow-up from Camp David in 78. And what happened in that process that...
Well, what happened was this. President Carter had gone to Camp David after having talked about the need for the Palestinians to have a homeland. And just about the same time he said that, a new government came into office in Israel, headed by Menachem Begin. And Begin was committed to an ideology of the greater land of Israel, greater Eretz Israel. And he made very, very clear that he was not going to budge in terms of giving the Palestinians statehood, sovereignty, self-determination, anything of that sort. There was one people with rights in the land of Israel, and that was the Jewish people. And they had a right to absolute right to sovereignty over the entirety of the land of Israel. And he wasn't going to allow anything to interfere with that. And so at Camp David, the president was unable to budge Begin on this issue, even though he pushed him towards peace with Egypt. And later on, there was a peace treaty with Egypt. So one of the subsidiary arguments of the book is that the United States can get what it wants from Israel if it had overwhelming strategic interest in doing so. And the strategic interest here was moving Egypt from the Soviet column to the American column in the Cold War. The first episode that I talk about in the book has to do with the follow-on to Camp David, when in the wake of the Lebanon War of 1982, when Israel invaded and 50,000 Palestinians and Lebanese were killed and wounded, the Reagan administration saw an opportunity to implement the sort of frozen Palestinian provisions of the 1978 Camp David Accords. The president promulgated a plan, which came to be known as the Reagan Plan, on the 1st of September, 1982. And I cite at great length a document, a now declassified document, by a CIA analyst, which one of my students actually found, a PhD student working with me found, which lays out in excruciating detail exactly how Begin would dig in his heels in response to the Reagan Plan. That proved to be a perfectly accurate prediction. The Israeli Prime Minister wouldn't budge. The Reagan Plan disappeared without a trace. The President backed down. I argue that this episode, both what Carter ended up doing at Camp David and what Reagan ended up doing with his own plan, is the first instance where American presidents have come up to the brink in realizing that they had to push beyond a certain level, beyond the, you know, push the envelope, as it were, and backed down. So that's the first episode that I talk about in the book, and that's the first substantive chapter, actually, of the book.
Let me ask one question about that, because you start mm-hmm. that with Begin, and then in the book you give a whole list of Israeli prime ministers after that.
Right.
And you say essentially whether they're, I guess there might have been a labor guy.
There were two, and you had Prime Minister Rabin.
And you say that their positions have really been no different.
Essentials, the issues on which Begin dug in his heels most deeply, that is what has determined not only Israeli policy, but the ceiling of what the United States would push for. Rabin did make changes. Begin was fundamentally opposed to accepting the idea that there was such a thing as a Palestinian people. Rabin accepted that, and that's enshrined in the Oslo Accords that were signed on the White House lawn in September of 1993. Even when Israeli prime ministers did say, we support a Palestinian state, under their breath they said, yes, but we're going to keep control over the crossings, we're going to keep control of the river, we're going to keep this, keep that, things that amount to such limitations on sovereignty that we're not really talking about statehood. We're talking about Bantustans, we're talking about some kind of fake autonomy. Again, this is another word that's used, in my view, dishonestly or deceitfully. Autonomy, self-determination are used by people in American political parlance and Israeli political parlance in ways that do violence to the real meaning of these words, in other words, in an Orwellian fashion.
Let's fast forward up to Obama, because Obama had a learning curve, too. Talk to us about where he started and where he is now. You talked about the second one briefly in the beginning. Your third one is Obama.
Right. The second one is the negotiations I was involved in from 91 to 93. And subsequent negotiations under President Clinton. And the third third chapter of the book deals with our current president. Two things to be said about Obama. The first is that he fits the pattern of every president since President Carter, with the sole exception of George W. Bush. And that pattern has been one where presidents have come into office recognizing that if they really do want to achieve some kind of progress on the Palestinian issue, they have to push the envelope. And in every case they tried to do so, Clinton tried, Obama tried, before them George Herbert Walker Bush, President Bush Sr. tried, and even President Reagan and President Carter tried. All of them tried, and all of them failed, and in the end pulled back. So that's the first thing to be said about President Obama. At the beginning of his administration, he came out arguing that there had to be a Palestinian state quickly, that that state should have borders more or less defined by the 1967 Green Line, the Armistice Line, and with minor swaps, finally, that there should be a settlement freeze during negotiations. And he ended up backing down on all of these issues, as every one of the presidents I just mentioned backed down. That said, one of the arguments I make in the book is that in his rhetoric, in his speeches, right up to and including the recent speech in Jerusalem during his presidential visit there, this president has adopted wholesale an entirely Israeli narrative as to the nature of the conflict, as to the idea that Israel is a victim, as to the idea that Israel is and will always be in existential danger, as to the link not only between the Holocaust and Israel in the present, but the possibility of a new recurrence of this kind of horrible event. Every one of these tropes, as well as many other tropes of the Israeli narrative are integral to every speech he has given on this subject.
Now, I thought that was a really interesting part of your book when you discuss existential danger to a people and you say how it's really been reversed.
Precisely. I mean, there is a people in existential danger. That's the Palestinians.
Yeah.
There's a people that is threatened with elimination, extermination, extinction, not physically, but as a collective. In other words, this is a people which may never be allowed the right of national self-determination and will be dispersed to the winds in a way that is likely, possible, whatever. And yet what we're constantly told by our politicians and our media is that it's Israel's security that is in danger because there is an existential, an absolute danger to the very existence of the state of Israel. The president mentions this in almost every one of his speeches.
And it's bought into completely by the American people at this point, at least the majority of the American
people. Well, I mean,
people
have been beating this drum for 60-some-odd years, ever since, in fact, the founding of the state, back in 1948.
I want to go back to the second of the three incidents, the middle one,
mm-hmm.
When you were actually personally involved in
mm-hmm.
the negotiations. And that took place 91 to 93, and that was direct negotiations with Palestine and Israel.
Right.
And then Oslo comes out of that. Can you just explain how that happened and what you thought about Oslo at that point?
How that happened is the following. President Bush Sr. and Secretary of State Baker wanted to take advantage of the opportunity provided by the Gulf War in which Iraqi forces were pushed out of Kuwait and wanted to take advantage of the end of the Cold War and the arrival of a unipolar American hegemony in the world to try and resolve issues in the Middle East and make the United States more secure in its position in the region. And they wanted to do that by resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict. And they took the unprecedented step of bringing almost every one of the parties to the table simultaneously, including the Palestinians. So almost every Arab country was represented at Madrid, and in the subsequent multilateral negotiations that President Bush and Secretary Baker organized. This had never been done in the whole history of the conflict, by the way. Specifically, this is the first time that the Palestinians and the Israelis were brought to sit down together. As I argue in the book, the Palestinians sat down under enormously disadvantageous conditions. And it would take me longer than we have in this interview to describe every one of those disadvantageous conditions. For this and many other reasons, these negotiations didn't make very much progress. One of the main reasons was that the then Israeli government under Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir was dragged kicking and screaming to the table and had no intention of going one iota beyond the red lines that his predecessor, Prime Minister Begin, had laid down and that I talk about in the previous chapter. So we were up against a brick wall. Even after Prime Minister Rabin was elected, Rabin chose to focus on the Syrian front, changed his negotiator, brought in Itamar Rabinovich to negotiate with the Syrians, and immediately progress was made on the Syrian front. They came very, very close during Rabin's prime ministership. In fact, had the United States pushed a little harder, my sense is there would have been an Israeli-Syrian peace treaty. But he left the same Likud chosen, i.e. the same negotiator who had been chosen by Prime Minister Shamir, a hardline right-winger by the name of Eliakim Rubinstein, who is now, by the way, a high court judge in Israel, to continue the negotiations, and he didn't really change the parameters. Rabin finally allowed the PLO to be more involved at the table in Washington, but those negotiations went nowhere for a variety of reasons. I've described some of them, but another reason was the obstruction, I would argue, provided by American diplomats who continued to insist that Israel would not accept this or would not accept that at a time when we already knew, we the Palestinian negotiators and advisors already knew, that progress was being made elsewhere between Palestinians and Israelis. And so both Arafat and Rabin finally decided to cut out the useless American mediator and cut a deal directly, which is what they did in the Oslo Accords.
And that's what Oslo is. And you say, I think, talk about how Oslo led to the wall, more gobbling up of Palestinian territory.
Precisely. Oslo was a terrible deal for the Palestinians because of issues that I talk about in that chapter, issues like jurisdiction and territorial control and limitations that Rabin maintained in what he envisioned for Palestinian autonomy. Unfortunately, Rabin was not able to free himself of that, even though he went, as I've already said, he went farther than any Israeli prime minister had in accepting that there was a Palestinian people and negotiating with the PLO and so forth. He didn't take the final step, which was to say the Palestinians are a people with an inalienable right to national self-determination and to statehood and to complete and total independence and to control of their own lives and their security. He never took that final step, nor, in my view, has any Israeli prime minister since.
We're speaking with Rashid Khalidi, who's a professor at Columbia. He's written a very good book called Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. Rashid, let's bring it up to date now. What's your assessment of the PLO? And secondly, your assessment of a two-state solution, or if that doesn't work, a one-state solution. Where do you think we're at now?
Well, let me talk briefly about the PLO, because the PLO is in a state of decrepitude. It's been more or less abandoned by most of the PLO leadership who migrated into the occupied territories when they were allowed to do so after the Oslo Accords, and have become preoccupied with running the little rump autonomy that they were granted by Israel in those accords, and have neglected the majority of Palestinians who live outside the occupied territories in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and elsewhere, and have neglected, in my view, the idea that this organization is directed at achieving Palestinian national objectives, which include ending the occupation and bringing about a just solution to the refugee issue. No progress has been made on these issues. In fact, I think we've gone backwards, as I've suggested. So the PLO, or the Palestinian National Movement, really needs a complete shakeup. Both of the two main political parties in presence, both Fatah and Hamas, I think have failed in their duty to provide a clear idea of a strategy unifying the Palestinian National Movement. I mean, the Palestinians are the weaker party here. They cannot afford the kind of divisions that exist as between Fatah and Hamas, as between the West Bank and Gaza. And these leaderships, in my view, are culpable for their failure to do all of these things. I think they've very poorly served the Palestinians. In part as a result of Palestinian failures since the 90s, a situation has emerged in which we now, I think, have one state and one sovereign body between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, and that is the state of Israel. So whether we like it or not, whether people are willing to admit it, I mean, I think the emperor has no clothes. I think we have a one-state solution. That is what we're going to have for the foreseeable future. And the only question is this going to be a one-state solution with gross inequalities as between Jewish Israeli citizens, and then on a rung down on the ladder, Palestinian citizens of the state of Israel who have some rights but are excluded from a whole range of other rights, like owning and renting the overwhelming majority of land within the state of Israel, which they're not allowed by law to occupy, rent, or own. I mean, these are the kinds of restrictions on citizenship and on rights that would be unacceptable in any democracy, but they're integral to the way in which the Israeli legal system is organized. And then finally, much further down the ladder, in varying steps down towards the lowest circle of hell, are other Palestinians who have almost no rights, people in the Gaza Strip or people in the occupied West Bank. That is the reality that we face today. And the question for anybody who advocates a two-state solution is, how do you reverse the processes that are ongoing, that have created this situation, and that are consecrating it and reinforcing it every day, whether it's settlement, whether it's settlements, whether it's other means whereby a matrix of control is imposed on the Palestinians. And I don't know the answer to those questions. I mean, I'm a historian. I can try and help explain why we got where we are and what I see as the dynamics that have been in play up till now. I don't know how you change those things into the future, but that is the situation we're in. And airy-fairy talk about a one-state solution where everybody's equal would require people to explain how we get from where we are today, the state that we're in today, to that state, or airy-fairy talk about a two-state solution, which I think is even more unrealistic, requires similarly a sort of a roadmap. How do you get from where we are today to where we would want to be?
Your book takes up really one of the great crimes of post-World War II history with the really ethnocide against the Palestinians. And you show that the peace process is all process and no peace.
Mm-hmm.
Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East by Rashid Khalidi, just out by Beacon Press, put it out at Courageous Press in Boston. And we're so grateful for your hard work in giving us this book,
well,
Rashid.
Thank you.
And we want to thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Not at all. Thank you so much for
thank
having
you,
me.
Thank you, Rashid.
Bye-bye, guys. Take care.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Go in those right through.
Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals recently ruled that a legal challenge to military spying on peace activists can proceed. This is the first time a court has allowed civilians to sue the military for violating their First and Fourth Amendment rights. National Lawyers Guild attorney Larry Hildes brought the lawsuit, Panagakos v. Tauri, in 2009 on behalf of several Washington State anti-war activists who discovered they were infiltrated for 2 years by John Tauri. Tauri was a civilian employee at a fusion center inside a local army base. Working with other law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Homeland Security, the goal was not just to infiltrate, but also to destroy the peace organizations. Joining us to discuss the larger implications of this case is attorney Larry Hildes. Larry Hildes, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
In 2009, activists in Washington State learned through FOIA-requested documents that an informant working for the U.S. military was spying on their anti-war groups in Olympia and Tacoma. What did the activists learn,
well,
specifically?
It was an interesting story. Brendan Dunn was an activist in Olympia. He was arrested in Seattle, basically for sitting while anarchist. He and a couple of friends were having lunch during a rally with an anarcho-syndicalist flag. Seattle police officer came up and arrested them for refusing to give him the flag. And about the same time in Olympia, the Olympia Police Department cracked down on the Wobblies, on the IWW, for having newspaper boxes, which they'd paid for and had permission to have, and took all the papers. So we got them back, but in the meantime, Brendan got kind of curious about what was going on, did a State Public Records Act request for all emails and all intelligence to the city of Olympia concerning anarchists or the IWW. What he got back instead was hundreds and hundreds of pages of what are called force protection memos and threat assessments from Fort Lewis about Port Militarization Resistance, a group that he was involved with that did protest against the use of public ports for shipment of Stryker vehicles and the Stryker Brigade equipment to the occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. He hadn't been expecting any of this. Nobody knew it existed at that point other than the people doing it and the people involved in the spying.
Do you think it was an accident they released so much information?
We still have no idea. We don't know if it was someone sympathetic at the city or they released it by mistake or they wanted to scare them more. We've been speculating about this for the last 3.5, almost 4 years. But he started looking at them, and every police department and every military agency from north of Seattle to Portland was on this list. The FBI was on this list. Homeland Security was on it. Every branch of the military. So they started wondering, who are these people?
And meaning that's the distribution list so that all of those entities receive this threat assessment.
Right. Every one of these things went to this whole laundry list of agencies, and it was detailed discussions about what PMR was planning, what they were going to do, how to fight it, tons and tons of the stuff. And they started looking at the names on the list, and the author of a lot of these was listed as John Tauri. So they started trying, and he didn't have a title listed, so they started trying to find out, who is John Tauri?
By they, you mean who, Larry?
Brendan Dunn and a colleague named Drew Hendricks, who does the intelligence and research for PMR and for a number of other groups. He's also Olympia Cop Watch.
PMR is what again?
Port Militarization Resistance. I'm sorry.
It's okay. That's a peace group, essentially.
Yeah. So they used very legal means to try and track this stuff. And the first thing they did is they looked for a Facebook page. And there's a picture on John Towery's Facebook page of a guy they recognized as John Jacob, who had been coming to PMR meetings, to events for several years, had been involved with very closely involved with PMR. In fact, he ran their email listserv through RiseUp.
So he had control of the peace group's email listserv.
Right. And strange things had been happening with the email for a while. Things were ending up in hands they shouldn't have been. The email would stop working right before key action. So someone, they were getting an idea that something weird was going on.
Classic infiltration.
Right. So they did some more checking. They looked up his voter registration information. They got an address. And the address matched John Jacobs. So they sent someone to go by the house and take a picture. And there was John Jacobs' car and John Jacobs' motorcycle.
They did their own intel.
Yes. And they didn't out him at first. They didn't do any of the things that people mistakenly do. They didn't snitch jack it. They didn't start rumors. They carefully and methodically checked all of this stuff. And on his Facebook page, it said he worked for the Army in force protection doing intelligence.
That's stunning.
Not very intelligent.
Not very intelligent.
So at that point, they confronted him.
And didn't he have a nickname, Agent Orange?
He went by Agent Orange, which I've got to say, the first couple times I heard it, I thought, this is weird. Is he flagging information? And then we just decided, okay, it's clever, it's Agent Orange. I will say there were some people who, in retrospect, were suspicious, but at the time, I don't know how, because he was 20 years older than everybody else, but he blended in. He went to events, he brought his kids, he drove a group of people in his truck down to the Anarchist Book Fair in Portland. He was very interested, he seemed to have some idea of the politics, and he was charming. And people believed him. And these are people who were, a lot of them were very aware of security culture and checking people out and being careful. But he was very, very good at what he did. And he fooled enormous numbers of people. Brendan considered him a close friend. Other people did. So Brendan and another one of our plaintiffs, a man named Glenn Crespo, confronted him at a cafe in Tacoma. And he said, yes, I've been spying on you. I'm doing it for your own good. There's other spies watching you who mean you much more harm than I do.
Okay, Larry, that's stunning. He said, I'm doing it for your own good.
He did.
And what did he mean by that?
We still don't know. But the presumption was, if you don't let me do it, there's worse out there. And we do know that the Army had at least one more spy. We caught the Coast Guard spy. There were two officers from the Tacoma Police Department's Homeland Security Committee who at various times monitored things and attended meetings. There were others from various agencies who tried to get on the listserv or showed up at meetings and were not allowed to continue.
We're talking to an attorney named Larry Hildes, one of the attorneys responsible for an important victory in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals regarding the question of whether they can sue the military for spying on peace activists in the Seattle area and more.
So they confronted him, and then what happened in terms of, did the group decide they wanted to sue? Did they contact you? What happened next?
Well, I'd been representing the group on several criminal cases, and there were ongoing discussions about the fact that the police seemed to know in advance that what they were planning. They would show up for unannounced demonstrations, and the MPs and the local police and the state patrol would already be there, and everyone would be arrested as soon as they showed up as they were getting out of their cars, they'd get arrested.
Before they did anything. So these were unlawful arrests.
Right.
And amounted to a pattern of harassment, would you say?
Absolutely. And they succeeded in basically shutting PMR down. Now, poor militarization resistance was only a few dozen people at most. They were very creative. They had figured out a choke point for the military. If they couldn't get the equipment to Iraq and Afghanistan, the equipment would go out 3 weeks before the troops. If they couldn't get the equipment there, they couldn't send the troops. If they couldn't send the equipment or the troops, then no war. And they clearly succeeded in scaring back out of the military by these very peaceful acts of civil disobedience. And about 80% of the time, they didn't even do civil disobedience. They did demonstrations. They tried to talk to the soldiers who were taking the equipment to the port or from the port and had really good discussions with them, which also scared the military. So they did these actions, but when there would be a crackdown, Tacoma basically would not allow them to have a demonstration on public property at the port under any circumstances by the second year of this. So they went to the freeway ramps and blocked the equipment from getting off the freeway to go to the port of Tacoma. Every time the military and the police tried to do something, they did something else. So for a while, they were able to really work around this. But eventually, it prevented them from mostly from demonstrating. They were spending all their time dealing with criminal cases. People started fighting with each other.
Which is exactly what happened during COINTELPRO in the 50s and 60s with government infiltration and disruption, preying on interpersonal relationships. So this sounds like a classic COINTELPRO type case, but with very clever activists who, I mean, it must have been a great coup to discover Towery because then all the pieces fit together.
Exactly. Yeah, all of a sudden everything made sense. They were playing around with the criminal cases, too. The first civil disobedience that they did back in 06 at the Port of Olympia, they wouldn't let people into the port, so they sat on the line and blocked the main entrance gate, got arrested. Right after the first set of Tacoma demonstrations at the port in March of 07, we went to trial on that case. And we had 17 defendants, 9 of whom were pro se, and we had 6 lawyers. I was representing 4 people. So every time any officer or anyone from the port got up, they got cross-examined by 17 people. And, of course, we had all those peremptory challenges. So we had a really good jury, and it was very clear by the time the state called its 4th or 5th witness that we were going to win the case. And all of a sudden, strange things started happening. The first prosecutor tried to put in evidence illegally, got yelled at for the 3rd or 4th time, left the court in tears. So they called a recess for the rest of the day. The next day, at the lunch break, just after the lunch break, prosecutor who replaced her said to the judge, "We need a minute. We have an ongoing situation, and we need a sidebar." So they bring in a sheriff's deputy. We had an attorney-client email listserv that was confidential and was closed. It was only open to attorneys, the defendants, and the legal workers on the case. Karen had sent out on Friday an analysis of the jurors from the spreadsheets we had. She put together a spreadsheet from the questionnaires. They show up in court with that spreadsheet and say, "This is all over the internet." And we start screaming, they start screaming, the judge starts screaming. So finally, the listserv administrator for that listserv is one of the defendants. And he gets on the court computer, logs on, and lo and behold, there's 2 names that no one has ever seen before. One of which turns out to be John Towery. The other one is a Tacoma police detective who we now have emails from talking to a colleague bragging about the fact that they got onto the listserv and disrupted the trial and lamenting the fact that they've been kicked off all the listservs. So we knew there was weird stuff going on, and that case eventually was dismissed by the court for prosecutorial misconduct.
Now, Larry, let's fast forward a little bit so people know the broader picture. You brought a case in which you alleged that Towery had infiltrated, there was a pattern of disruption and violation of a constitutional right.
Right.
And what happened with the judge's ruling?
Well, we ended up with a group of about 12 people who decided to sue. 7 of them pushed forward. We filed. The lawyers for Towery and Tom Rudd, who was Towery's supervisor, it was Rudd who was putting out these threat assessments. based on Towery's information, immediately filed what are known now as Iqbal motions. Motions to dismiss saying we had failed to state a claim for which relief can be granted because you can't sue the military for spying. We responded, we won. Very conservative judge in the Western District of Washington said we had alleged enough to show First and Fourth Amendment violations because people were getting arrested. Brendan Dunn got stopped and ticketed or arrested 5 times. We beat each one of them. Several of these people had arrest after arrest, strange incident after strange incident.
Didn't one person lose his apartment because his landlord found out?
Two entire households. There was a house in Olympia, which in retrospect should have picked a different name, jokingly referred to itself as HQ. And several of the people involved with PMR in Olympia lived in HQ, just outside downtown Olympia. In Tacoma, there was a house called Pitch Pipe, which included several of the PMR activists from Tacoma. Both houses got raided repeatedly. At one point, I was at the Guild Convention in D.C., we got a call because the Tacoma Police Department and some unknown other agency were going to raid the house to stop an anarchist book fair, which is a very innocent gathering where people buy and sell literature and talk about politics, and went to the landlord and said, you have terrorists in the house. If you don't get them out, we're going to charge you with terrorism. Kick them out. They moved. The new place suddenly had a camera outside of it aimed from a traffic pole. HQ got kicked out by the landlord after similar threats. So they totally disrupted the lives of a dozen to two dozen people involved with PMR, including most of our plaintiffs.
Larry, let me step back for a second, because Heidi and I, and maybe you, but you know, we're like litigators who came out of the 60s and the 70s, with a case called Laird v. Tatum,
yes,
in which the Supreme Court of the United States said, you can't sue the military for violating your First Amendment rights just because they're keeping track of the demonstrations and clipping newspapers because you haven't really shown that you've been injured by this.
Right.
Now, your case, the reason they tried to dismiss your case was based on that Supreme Court case, Laird v. Tatum.
Absolutely.
And what's really historic about what you've done is you were able to go farther and really, I wouldn't say undercut that holding, but say that that shouldn't be the law for all time in terms of suing the military. Now, how are you, I guess what you've been explaining is the injury that
exactly
people actually had, so you can, that's how you got around it.
Right, and they appealed to the Ninth Circuit, they argued Laird, and they argued that you couldn't possibly state a case, and we said that Laird says you can't sue the military unless you have other damages, and Laird hints that arrests would be enough to overcome it if you can show a pattern, and that's exactly what we did. We showed how many times a bunch of these people had been stopped, had been arrested, the pattern of cracking down on them, the fact that they would arrest them not only at demonstrations but before they got to demonstrations. And in the case of Jeff Berryhill, one of our plaintiffs, at least once standing outside of his house on the sidewalk talking to someone. And they disrupted the households. Brendan Dunn finally was forced to leave Olympia because they really, really intensely went after him with character assassinations a la COINTELPRO. So we brought a lot of this up to the Ninth Circuit, and Judge Fletcher Jr., the son of the late Betty Fletcher, asked us that question. Well, they can investigate because your clients might do illegal things and might be engaged in dangerous behavior. I said, maybe. Of course, our clients were never involved in dangerous behavior. The worst they did was civil disobedience. But they can't arrest them before they even get to the demonstration or before they even do anything. Half of our plaintiffs are women who were involved with a planned women's action where the police blocked off the street at night. There were no strikers anywhere in sight. The strikers were hidden back behind the fence. They were going to take a different route anyway. And they arrested them all for attempted disorderly conduct.
Now, there is no such charge.
There isn't. Either you're disorderly or you're not. If you block traffic in Washington, you could be charged with disorderly conduct. But there's no traffic. The police blocked off the whole area. So they charged them with basically a thought crime. And the court was persuaded by that and by the pattern of arrests and the attacks on the two collective houses and said, yes, if you can show actual damages, you can overcome Laird and you can sue the military. And to our knowledge, and I checked extensively, this is the first time an appellate court has ever said this since Laird.
Larry, this is historic, truly. I mean, Michael and I are sitting here looking at each other because this is one of those rare times. We've had so many cases, especially since 9/11, where the injustices are blatant and right out there, and a judge dismisses them.
Oh, yeah.
This is stunning.
How pervasive do you think this kind of military spying and disruption is in places outside of Seattle?
Unfortunately, I think it is much more pervasive in the set of emails and other information that Brendan got from the Public Records Act requests. There was a series of communications between the PMR SDS, Students for Democratic Society, task force at McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey and the Olympia Police Department. Now, I don't know why they're, first of all, I don't know why the Air Force involved at all. But secondly, I don't know why the McGuire Air Force Base, 3,000 miles away, has a PMR SDS test. What it says to me, coupled with the fact I think they got caught in Alaska as well, is that this is going on. This is what the fusion centers were created to do. They circumvented the previous constitutional law and allow the military to work with civilian law enforcement, allow all of the federal agencies to work with all the local ones, and as a result, they systematically spy on all sorts of people. And I know that there was a congressional report blasting the fusion centers for rampant abuses, for fraud, and for mostly investigating people who were engaged in lawful activity. So, unfortunately, I think this is probably going on a lot. The military does not like dissent, and the lines between the military and civilian law enforcement and military tactics and police tactics have blurred to the point that I think they have a green light to do whatever they want, and they've decided that dissent against their wars is the enemy, which scares me a great deal. But I think that's where we are, and that's why this case is important enough for us to have hung on through several years of foot-dragging and appeals. The attorneys for Towery and Rudd have now said that they're tired of this case being around and they're going to allow us 2 months of discovery and then move for summary judgment. I think they're worried about what we're going to find out, and we're going to fight them very hard. We're demanding enough time to do this properly because we want to know the answer to that question too. Where else are they doing this? How much are they doing this? And this has got to stop. This is unacceptable and what purports to be a free society.
Larry, you just raised so many critical points in terms of the blurring of the lines between military and civilian law enforcement, as it were, and how the fusion centers have really made a mess of all of this. So we're going to have you back to talk about this, especially as the case goes forward. But we want to thank you so much for sticking with this important case. And I think that what the case does is give a really rare glimpse into this larger picture that we often just find out by accident.
Right.
And if there was someone in the state who issued those reports out of sympathy, we extend our thanks to that person.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for being with us. This was a really important case and really has national implications. And that you're getting at the trial is utterly remarkable.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Heidi.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Someone, dear.